Be long, we'll go ahead and get started. We can enjoy the slurps of those folks that are still working on their cones. That's great. I love it. So, I'm Wayne Daly. I'm the chair of the Science and Technology Advisory Committee, and we do have a few visitors here that didn't participate in our meeting this afternoon. And those of you that weren't there this afternoon, you're welcome to attend again tomorrow. We start at 9, and we'll continue on after lunch for a brief period of time as well. But just to give all of us a refresher on the Science and Technology Committee, I'm going to read just a little bit of the Science and Technology Committee guidelines and mission statement. I was looking at that this afternoon, and it just dawned on me, it's good to bring these things back to the table again from time to time so that we can keep focused on the importance of what we do for the village. So if you bear with me, the mission statement is: the Holden Village Science and Technology Committee seeks to provide information and expertise in sustaining a viable municipality, to provide technical assistance to the Holden Village management on request, to suggest possible directions for a vision of Holden's long-range future, to strengthen Holden's educational program through teaching, projects, publications, and internships. The Holden Village Science and Technology Committee provides advice, information, and ideas to the Holden Village management, operations manager, business manager, and directors, as requested, to support the mission of Holden Village. The committee is an advisory group and will not make decisions affecting village policy, priorities, or budget. And, to me that is a real important statement, because our input is really important to the direction that the village goes. And for me as a newcomer, I really am a very new person to this activity, and I consider myself still a beginner. I've been coming up to the village now for 6 years, I was immediately impressed with the activities of the Science and Technology Committee, it was for me an instant opportunity to share my expertise, but to learn from those people who have been here for a long period of time. And to those folks who have been longtime members here, I thank you, because what you do is really important. And I would hope that we can all continue to maintain a focus and a continued support for the community. So it's a vital part, and I think Christopher could agree with the importance that's gone on, and as well as Chuck, you're a longtime board member, and you certainly have history and memory, as well as you had a son who served on this committee as chair, as probably the leadership, the direction that was beginning for all of us, I think. So, to all of you, I say thank you, and I hope we can continue. And I'd like to make sure that we have a lot of fun, too.
I'd like to add that the committee membership is open to everybody. So some of you that have come here out of some interest in what we're doing, if you have an interest in joining, you're welcome to do so. Talk to Wayne and get on the roster, and you'll receive the minutes. And we encourage everyone is welcome as a guest to come to the meetings, but as a member, you'd also be on a list that would be available to the village that we can call upon. And maybe you have time and maybe you don't, but you would be joining a group of advisors to the village, which has been a very important thing in the past. So please feel free to come as often as you'd like and to join when you're ready.
And tonight's forum is really informal. I mean, we're just hopefully we can have some roundtable discussion questions. If there are any questions for myself or for Christopher that any of you have in relation to the operation of the village, I would hope that you will. And it doesn't necessarily have to relate to fire and ice, but the title Fire and Ice I thought was appropriate given the amount of smoke that we have in the village right now, and our discussions we've had over the last couple of years now concerning the glaciers in the basin, and particular back in Copper Basin, where we depend very heavily, or to a certain degree, on the snow melt and the ice melt from the glacier that still remains in Copper Basin. So I guess to get things started on the issue of fire, maybe you could give us an update, any new information as far as the fire issue is concerned, Christopher.
I think most of you know that there's two fires burning in our neighborhood, and a third one not too far away. The Tin Pan Fire is just over the ridge behind us. Started in July from a lightning strike. There were a couple of days in July where it burned close to the ridge and made us a little bit nervous in the village. But since then, it's burned away from those vulnerable spots of coming into Railroad Creek Valley, and it's considered a beneficial fire at this point. In the last few days, it has given them a little bit of a run for its money. It's spotted over Snow Brushy Creek, which was one of the lines that wanted to keep it from spotting over, but they've contained those spots, and so far they're still considering a beneficial burn that's actually improving the situation on the other side of the ridge. And then up by Stehekin is the Foot Creek Fire, which also in the last few days, with the warmer, more drier weather, has spotted down into Hazard Creek, into Purple Creek, above Stehekin. So it's burning about 2 miles away from Stehekin right now, and at about 6,000 feet of elevation in those drainages. When it burns, and it's burning, it's backing down those drainages as normal fire behavior. If it gets down to 3,000 feet, it will trigger a level 2 evacuation notice for Stehekin. So there's still some possibility that that will occur for Stehekin. But so far, that one has not burned structures. It's in a very remote and very steep location. And 2 years ago, this month, in fact, 2 years ago, last week, Holden Village evacuated when we hit a level 2 evacuation trigger for the Deep Harbor Fire. So fire is a very large part of our reality here in the summertime, especially late summer in August, when the weather is hot and dry. There's a lot of fuels in this valley, a lot of fuels that would cause a very large fire under the right conditions. So how Holden Village would survive a fire like that is one of the things that this committee talks about, and one of the priorities for our long-range planning at Holden. And if you go up to Chalet Hill, you see the metal roofs going on the chalets, and that's a large part because of fire danger and survivability. So that's a big topic, and it's related to climate change and the fire part of our title tonight.
Yeah. So please come on in.
When's the last time there was a fire in Railroad Creek, a severe fire? Do people know? Have there been one recorded history?
Yes, about 100 years ago, maybe a little bit more than 100 years ago now, was the last major fire. So we're well past the normal cycle of when there would be a large fire here. And that's why the fuels have grown to such a large degree. The number of trees per acre is quite a bit higher than would normally be the case if the valley had been allowed to burn on a normal rotation.
But much of the area here as well is a part of the problem we have throughout this western area is there's a beetle infestation in a number of the evergreen trees, and you'll see a lot of dead trees that and a heavy stand of dead trees. You'll see a few up if you walk up towards Copper Basin, where you'll see quite a number of trees right together. They're a reddish color, and they're a real part of that fire threat, because in many cases there are also some of the taller trees, and they provide a real lightning rod for a lightning strike. And that's oftentimes where those fires start, is the lightning caused fires. It's a dead tree that is still standing. So, Mike?
Well, thank you. I just wanted to say I don't recollect the fire situation being quite that easy to brush off. During the middle 60s, we had fire. The Swiss group that was logging here had the High Line, and they had a fire beginning at the top of their donkey area. And I remember the thing developing so big that they dropped in the parachutes, they dropped in the firefighters, and we were up there. They called out the village staff people to go up there and help fight. We were cutting lines, dropping hoses.
It's not that there hasn't been a fire. There's been many small fires in this valley. Do you know how large that one was, Mike?
That's the part I don't remember, is how big it got. But it's so close, and I was just surprised at the magnitude of the efforts to scale the thing and determine who's going to evacuate when here we were asked to go fight it instead of...
Yeah, it only burned a few inches.
In fact, we've had, I think, 4 or 5 fires in this valley since I've been here. They've all been suppressed, you know, readily. I'm not sure of the largest, you know, maybe 10 or 15 acres. There's probably been larger ones, but as far as a valley-wide fire that's cleaned out the fuels, it's my understanding it was back in the 1800s.
So does the Forest Service have a projection in the case of a valley-wide wildfire on the survivability of the village?
Now, that was a very large topic of conversation 2 years ago when the village was empty and there was property protection experts from the Forest Service working with our own staff to set up some systems in place to increase that survivability. And nobody would really go on record. It all depends on the fire. There's certainly potential fires that would come through that there's nothing that could be done to save the village. But there's a lot of other scenarios. With less wind and a little more moisture, the fires that would come through and may burn around the village, especially if we do our part in getting ready with defensible space, metal roofs, and we've talked a little bit today about the purple pipe system, about a system of bringing more water and more moisture into the village during a wildfire. So under a lot of different scenarios, the village would survive. Under some, it wouldn't. And what we want to do is continually increase those odds into our favor. But a large firestorm with a big wind behind it coming up this valley, it's very doubtful there'd be anything here left. But under other situations, a creeping fire that they're battling with a lot of resources and we're putting water in the village, you know, there are lots of instances where a wet place in the forest or a little more a humid pocket, the fire would just burn around it. And, you know, that's what we're trying to create. Right now, with the shake roofs on, it wouldn't take much of a fire at all. They got those 14 chalets burning. And once they start burning, then the other buildings are without a structural protection crew here, would quickly follow. And under the Forest Service safety rules, in a dead-end valley like this, it's unlikely there would be anyone left behind to fight it. Everyone would be evacuated under many fire scenarios.
Well, that's the fire side of things, and it's a bit scary, but at the same time, it provides encouragement for us to work hard towards trying to do what we can as a community to protect the area and enhance the areas of protection with sprinkler systems and treating the area with respect as well. It's been very impressive to me to see the emphasis on smoking being reduced, and people have been really good about obeying those requirements and regulations. So I think the village does a great job in enhancing the safety of the area in terms of fire.
The Flick Creek fire was human caused, by the way. Most of these fires have been lightning caused, but that one was human caused. And there was at least one forest fire in this valley that was started by our own Holden Village staff who were camping and had a campfire in a area where campfires weren't allowed. So one thing we have to be extremely careful of is that we're not the cause of a fire that's going to be the end of Holden or be a huge fire in this valley, which we'd be responsible for suppression costs of. So that's... our bottom line responsibility is not to cause the fire ourselves.
The issue of ice We last year at this time had a great discussion at a forum, and we had an opportunity to talk about a lot of the issues concerning climate change. We won't go into the politics of what's causing the climate change, but it is happening. It's you just can't deny it. The science is there, and the indications are that we'll continue to see changes in our climate conditions. Some of the things that are happening here in the Northwest along that line, they've been doing a significant amount of monitoring of snowpack in the entire region, but there are some charts that are available that unfortunately I didn't. I thought I had brought a couple of CDs with me with some PowerPoint information, and unfortunately I grabbed the wrong material off of the computer. But the one area that is very, very pointed in terms of the decline in snowpack is the data that's being collected on the east slope of the Olympic Mountains, Snow Creek drainage. And the data that's been monitored now for about 60 years, there's a very negative slope to the snowpack in that watershed. And it's typical of most of the areas here in the Cascades as well. We're seeing this this change in snowpack. And we had our own experience that way winter before last. There was no, essentially no snowpack, and the village operated without burning firewood. We operated the entire village on a hydro system for the entire winter. I don't think that's ever happened before in the history of Holden Village, where you've gone through the entire winter operating the village with the hydro plant. We have a member of the committee that unfortunately can't get here to most of our meetings now. He's busy working down in Oregon, and he was a staff member here. And Casey did research on the glacier here in the Copper Creek Basin as part of his master's thesis. And that information was published for our meeting last year. And not only just the glacier itself, but his research was on the change in vegetation at the various elevations that are related to snowpack as well as temperature. And a very marked change in vegetation as you come up in the valley. And it's an indication of decreasing snowpack and change in temperatures late in the season. So that information is there. It's very, very definite. There's no, you can't argue with the science that's been used to collect this information and present it. I continue to monitor. There's a great website that is available for those of you that use computers. It's called the Columbia Basin Bulletin, and it's a weekly summary of technical information concerning the entire Columbia Basin watershed, not just this area here, but it covers everything that goes on in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And there's always at least one or two segments of that Columbia Basin Bulletin that are related to either snowpack or runoff in the Columbia River Basin. And that information is showing a very marked change in what's happening with the way things are being altered with this change in snowpack. Right. Yes, Dan.
Just to clarify, you talked about Holden going through a winter without burning firewood. Between you and Christopher, during that winter, diesel fuel, propane, firewood, how did that all work out? Are you saying you had enough hydropower to not use?
Yes.
Diesel?
Yes.
Propane?
Propane was used, okay. But not because we didn't have enough electricity.
Okay.
It was used for other reasons. basically the spring melt that year started in January. And the stream flows increased. In fact, we had close to flooding conditions in January as the temperature got warm. It was 50 degrees one morning in January, and it never really got cold again. Stream flows were up. Hydroelectric power was up just like the spring.
We had more power in January than we did the following October during the Lens Conference. We did stoke Koinonia for a week and the Essex for 2 or 3 days, and then the power came up and it stayed up. I mean, that was the low point. And that was right at the very beginning of January. And then we had, if I remember right, 150 kilowatts.
It's always our intention to use as electricity as our first choice and make it stretch as far as we can. And that winter we were able to do that. Plus, we heated some empty buildings, we heated the village center, and we had extra power for a good deal of the winter. And it was a wonderful thing heating the village center because the snow was so lousy that we played basketball and soccer instead of going skiing.
Paul?
We've talked over the last few years about the changing flow characteristics and that, and which you just went through, just amazing because maybe that's the future that we'd experience. Mm-hmm. Does the water right that the village have, does it require any kind of minimum stream flows be maintained?
No.
So we can take everything out of Copper Creek and run it through the... Mm-hmm.
And we typically do. In fact, Harry goes up there, you know, to stop up every little leak that goes over the dam and tries to convert it into the settling box.
That same year, what was the effect in terms of flow out of Copper Creek in the summer and then later on in the fall compared to other years?
We started closing the needle valve. We were taking the full creek by the middle of August.
Which is unusual.
And the fall was miserable.
They didn't have the storage.
Everything was shifted. Right. Shifted up, you know, quite a few months.
You lost that snowpack storage.
There wasn't much snowpack that winter. It was 130 inches, I think, something like that. Half the normal snowfall in the village.
A question back here?
It was similar to his. No,
okay.
That was my question. What happens? I mean, in the overall picture, is this for hydro, is it good or bad? In other words, or does it just shift as you spoke about?
Well, that was just a one-year experience. It hasn't repeated quite that way. So that year, it was probably beneficial. We saved 100 cords of firewood. We saved a whole seasons of work for a crew of people. We saved thousands of dollars in fuel, in diesel fuel. And we saved a lot of work that winter by using our and global warming impact by not burning fuel in the village. So a lot of benefits from it that year. We paid for it, but I think it balanced out. I think we still benefited more than we paid for it.
Well. Yeah, the lot of the people, like the water utilities in the Seattle, Tacoma area, besides there's two thinkings that are going on right now about the climate change process. One is what you experienced a year ago, and that is the temperature shift of you had a earlier spring runoff, and then, of course, once it's runoff, you've lost the storage capacity of the snow fields, and then you're losing probably some more of the glacier. But in some areas, there's going to be a microclimate change where that's what we had the most. And the Odin experience that you just talked about, you could probably shift our approach to using energy if we just had an earlier runoff and not had the storage. We then have to take care of the fall energy needs.
And late summer.
Yeah. Right. But the more damaging part of it would be is if you had a microclimate change where the rainfall dropped on a different part of the Cascades and then dropped into Copper Creek, and so they're creating precipitation. So that's something that nobody knows at this point.
And it's been rather convenient in the past that during the periods of high population at Holden, we've had ample electricity. And during the periods of low population is when we've been short. And if this shift continues, we're going to have periods of high population with low power. And that's going to be challenging.
It and one of the basic questions around that also is not only what's happening in Copper Creek, but what's happening in Railroad Creek. Because then, as the other discussion might be, is that with the mine cleaning up and the new energy source would be the question is there a way that we can access the hydro capacity within Railroad Creek, which is a larger body of water and larger snowfall or glacial feed, so that would have some real benefits.
Right. The watershed is a lot larger
right.
for Railroad Creek. Mm-hmm.
That's something that is on the table, I think, in terms of the minor mediation program. But it's probably one that could have the most difficulty in terms of permitting, but as has been mentioned, under some of the circumstances with using the quotes, the CERCLA permit process, they might be able to work around some of the permitting requirements. So.
I think you're going to see with the climate change debates that are going on now, it's going to have to be some rethinking and readjusting a lot of the existing installed systems, whether it be hydro or water or supply or whatever. And with that will come hopefully a little bit of common sense about the whole permitting process as well.
Sure.
Railroad Creek doesn't have the head that Copper Creek has.
Right.
What effect would that have on?
There are a number of low-head hydro systems, but what we would be faced with is taking water from Railroad Creek over a long distance, 3, 4, 5 miles probably, to get enough head differential to operate the low-head systems.
And we need more water to make up the difference.
Yeah, and that's where the problem comes in from the permit standpoint, because we would be taking water from a system that has fish in it. And that would be one of the biggest hurdles that we would have to pass. We don't have that problem in Copper Creek because there are no fish in Copper Creek above the confluence with Railroad Creek.
And the intake would be in the wilderness area.
And the intake could very well be in a wilderness area or right at the edge of the wilderness area.
The study that the village did some years ago would have the intake structure right at the wilderness border to avoid having it in the wilderness area. But if you could have it in the wilderness area, you'd get more head.
Right.
So, but that vastly increases. I mean, that's an act of Congress to do that. So that makes it harder.
Yeah.
Is there a sense of, after a winter of 350 inches of snow or whatever it was, any sense of restoration of snowpack?
Of glaciers or snowpack?
Well, glaciers, I assume not, but do you have any sense of how a winter like you had this last winter is going to affect things?
We've already seen in most of the river systems around here, if you go online to the USGS live flow data, they show the flow compared to a 50-year average. And we are already in the Stehekin system, in the Entiat, all of the river systems in this area, we're at about 10 to 15% of average flow. And so this has been occurring on a regular basis over the last 10 years now. It's been getting continually worse. So we're seeing the late season snowfall, in spite of heavy snowpack. I mean, 96, 97, we set a record on Mount Baker with a world record for the amount of snowfall in one season. But still, those river systems continue to show, by the end of the summer, a very significant reduction in flow over the 50-year average.
Is that a 10 to 15% decrease or 10 to 15%?
They're operating at about 15% of the 50-year average.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're saying that, are you sure about that? 15% of average flow or 15% below average?
They're about 15% of the 50-year average.
I find that hard to...
Go online to the USGS...
I find it hard to be in August with the lake full. And we're running 15% of of a 50-year average.
That wasn't the case in the spring. I mean, in the spring there was high flows and filled up the lake. In fact, they had to work really hard to keep the lake low enough to take all the water that was coming in the spring.
Yeah, there was a massive runoff in the spring. There's no question about that. But they've also been holding water back. They've not been generating power at the powerhouse in Chelan at a level to draw the lake down. So they are holding the lake artificially at that higher, much higher level.
If I could back up to the subject of fire, are there any scenarios that you've heard of where forestry would look at any kind of controlled burn on Murray Creek?
I think that eventually they will. They're really gun-shy about that. And we've brought that up a number of times, and they've, of course, studied it. They've done some very detailed analysis of what that might be like. But, you know, controlled burns, well, a good tool. To do it in a valley with a village at the end makes them kind of nervous. And this valley's so loaded with fuels, they've been reluctant to do that. And they've had a few problems, you know, with those things in the past. So I think eventually they will. But I think it's going to take the right political climate, and it's going to take perhaps some management in the Forest Service with a little more willingness to take risks, which is something they're averse to doing. I think we would support that, controlled burns in this valley. I want to point out that one of the things the committee is working on is alternative energy to fill this gap, especially this late summer gap, if that's what it turns out to be, where our hydropower has always been sufficient in the past. And we're talking about solar, we're talking about biofuels in the valley, and we've talked about wind, and there's a number of different alternative energy sources which we haven't needed here in the past, which we're looking at. So I would encourage those of you that haven't been part of this conversation already to state your opinion, your experience. Maybe you know something about some of these other systems and have some ideas or suggestions. You know, one time Holden Village put in a hydroelectric plant as a remarkable event for volunteers to do, looking to the future. And you know, now we're kind of in the same spot now. We're looking to the future, and we want to put in some type of alternative energy that's sustainable and can work in this environment. So that's what the committee's been talking about. And some of you may have an opinion about that.
I might share with you some research that I saw. I'm not certain, really certain. I have no idea how applicable it is to Lake Chelan. But there's some work at Oregon State University where they have looked at a piston in the ocean that would function to generate power. The efficiency is so high that there's a very fairly large community being serviced by a single unit. And it's often created the curiosity of whether or not there's enough wave action from wind in Lake Chelan that could.
Oh?
It's from wave energy,
not energy. Not from the wave. So swells and at least the arithmetic shows
to
be very affordable energy.
Uh-huh. We've talked about biodiesel, and just before I left to come up here, there was. I go online, the New York Times, every Tuesday. They have a science and environmental section that's published as part of the Times, and you can get to it online as well. There's some great information that they publish on a weekly basis, and one of the items that popped out at me here just a couple of weeks ago, biodiesel fuel, soybean or other oil that has been converted for use in diesel engines is slowly catching on in the United States. The National Biodiesel Board and Industry Group estimates that some 75 million gallons will be produced this year, triple the production of 2004. The fuel is most commonly mixed with petroleum, and that we're using biodiesel here. So it's we're part of that exciting change that's occurring in terms of the transition from the old traditional diesel to a biodiesel, something that's dependent upon agriculture crops instead of digging it out of the ground as oil or coal. And as Dave pointed out to me when we were talking about the conversion of that's going on in Canada in the oil sands fields, converting those oil sands to pure petroleum product. It costs as much to convert it as they save. In other words, for every million gallons of fuel that they make, it takes about a million gallons of energy to get there. So if they don't have the hydropower to make that conversion, then they're using petroleum products to get that oil out of that sand. So that's not the answer either. But I did hear on public radio as I was driving up here Monday morning that they're anticipating tripling their production of petroleum oil from the oil sands in Alberta. If you haven't seen the programs on public television, the process is ghastly. I mean, the pits that they're digging for the capture of this sand are hundreds of feet deep, and it just is a very destructive process in terms of environmental destruction. So that's not the answer either. So hopefully we can come up with some better solutions than that.
Well, you can ask the same question about the soybeans, because soybeans are made of oil too.
Yep.
Tractors that plow them, mm-hmm. the processing of them, the transportation of them, all over the world.
Yeah. Conservation has to become a part of our lifestyle. Yeah.
I read a report that Amazon rainforests are being cut down to grow soybeans to make oil to send to Britain to convert into chicken McNuggets coatings for McDonald's. What's the picture on growing not food crops, but actually being able to convert agricultural waste problems into net fuel?
Well, that's a good study that we need to do. Scott, you had a...
He got it.
He got it.
Yeah,
okay.
But energy is... How much energy does it take to make biodiesel?
Yep. There's a... In some of the study that I've done on biodiesel for some other reasons, one of the... interesting things to me is that there is a lobbying machine out there that in the agricultural world that is very large, and it's the soy business.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of rivals the oil industry in terms of the preferred product for making biodiesel. And soy has one of the lowest energy returns in terms of its oil form. But there is a very large crop of it that is generated. When numbers have been run in terms of utilizing soy as the basis for biodiesel, there are some numbers that there isn't enough land area on the globe to deal with the demand for petroleum products. But it was converted, and I think it related regardless of the type of oils being used. But there are some that are far more prolific at energy generation. Some of them that are actually grown in Washington from mustard seed, grape seed, in eastern Washington is much, much higher than soy. The oils of the South Pacific, palm and coconut and some of the more exotic ones are so high in energy that there are nations, island nations, that could become self-sufficient because of the energy release of those oils. But so it's an interesting blip in time because, as these things I read, the demand isn't high enough to sort of start showing its limitations, but as they sort of track it out, it's only a portion of the solution.
There's an interesting development. Brazil decided some couple of decades ago to get energy independence. And they went to alcohol gotten from cane, sugar cane. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a much more efficient way to get alcohol than is corn, which the U.S. is following. Mm-hmm. And to do it by the corn lobby.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But
there are some other spin-off values, though, of biofuels that go well beyond just the energy production, and that's the environmental safety of it when it comes to spills and handling and what it takes. The safety factor you gain by using these means that there's a spill, it doesn't turn into a hazardous waste. It's something very good.
Our son is involved in oil, and he was drawing my attention to it the other day that when oil was first beginning to be obtained and processed, the return was about 40 to 100 barrels of oil per barrel of oil invested. And it's now down to 4 and falling. Simply because it takes more energy to get more difficult oil. Yep.
So another area that is part of the puzzle, and certainly here in Holden Village, it isn't nearly the problem that it is outside of this area, is conservation. I mean, I think we're probably as conservation-minded about our power here as one can get, but in terms of the global picture, why at some point in time, I think that's an area that is going to have to receive a lot more emphasis. We've been in discussion here for about 45 minutes, and if any of you feel the need to leave, don't feel that you're going to cause problems for what we're trying to carry on with the discussion here, but certainly I will continue to answer questions or discussion items yes?
Did you already, maybe I missed it, say anything about the status of the mine remediation?
We haven't, but we could. Yeah. If there's, Christopher could give you perhaps a little better read on that than I can, but I have been involved in that process as well.
How far back do you want us to go, Ann?
No. Just generally the status as it is right now. I know it's a bit of a standstill.
Well, it's not so much a standstill as that the phase that we've been in for the last few years, where there was fairly intensive negotiation between the Intalco company and the agencies regarding the remedy, the potential remedy, has ended for now, and instead the agencies are carrying on within their own meetings and have indicated that they're going to select a remedy sometime this fall, and where everyone's curious to know what that's going to be. So it's changed format somewhat, and it's a little bit harder to tell, I mean, how much progress is being made, but there's indications that they are working towards selecting a remedy. And when that remedy is selected, then there'll be a whole new phase of conversation about how to implement it and whether the Intalco company is willing to implement that particular remedy and so forth. But it's a sort of a wait-and-see time right now.
So there's no schedule. If they do agree on one, they'd start immediately.
Well, there's lots of schedules.
Yeah, there's been a lot of schedules. Yeah, okay.
And none of them have come to pass. Of course, if a remedy is selected this fall, and if it's agreed to implement it, then there'll be public comment and a few other things, and then remedial design, and it could possibly be something they've been calling early actions next summer, some additional investigations and pilot projects and so forth, and perhaps something happening a year after that. So it's probably at least a couple of years away under the best of circumstances.
Are you aware of any things that are, for those of us that don't know the history at all, I mean, what's on the table here, or what have they talked about as a possibility?
There's been a lot that's been talked about and a lot of things that have been taken off the table. And the The remedy may look something like the portal effluent, the little stream that comes out of the 1,500-foot portal, the main portal of the mine, that little stream and a few other seeps, a few other places on this side of the project would be captured and gathered together and run through some type of treatment system, something to remove metals and to neutralize the acidity of that runoff, and then before it's released to Willow Creek. And then on the east side of the project, the tailings, the 80 acres of tailings, something would be done there as well to collect seeps that run through all those tailings and into Railroad Creek. And that one's a little trickier. It's a little harder to know exactly how that will be done. There's been quite a few scenarios that have been floated how to do that. Everything from creating a cutoff wall down to bedrock the entire length of the tailings from pile 1 all the way to pile 3 with an interception ditch that would capture as much as feasible and run that to a treatment system, to perhaps putting in a few wells that would remove the groundwater from the tailings and send that to treatment to reduce some of the peak loadings there. So there's a lot of range there. We don't really know what would be selected, but something will probably be required on the east side of the tailings as well. So the idea is to keep clean water out of the tailings and the mine, and then the water that does get in, treat it some way before it enters Railroad Creek. So there'll be diversion ditches and so forth above the tailings as well.
Going back to the climate change issue, there was one other item that I did pick up in the New York Times about a month ago. The area, what a number of forecasters or long-range weather people are saying, there's already a very strong indication that the agricultural activities in California, particularly the Napa Valley area, are showing a very significant impact from the temperature changes that are already occurring. And they're predicting that there is a very strong possibility that within 30 years, most of the grape growing activity of the western United States will shift to Oregon and Washington. And they will not be able to grow grapes in the area down around Napa Valley. So those are some of the beginning signs of climate change that the evidence is starting to increase as to what's going on. So we do need to be diligent in our activities as a science and technology committee to be sincere with our research and aggressive with it to see what we can come up with for alternatives to make sure Holden continues to function the way it always has.
Guys,
go ahead.
These are big, big, big pictures here, like, in the future.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that comes to mind, I've lived here for a year now, is just little things such as all the appliances being the ultimate energy efficient that they could be. And is this something that falls within science and technology, or is that... where does that idea fall? So, you know, just upgrading appliances in the whole village.
It's well agreed within the committee that the most bang for the buck in our first line is conservation.
Yeah.
And that is something the village has been doing for a long time, and the building remodels are the big part of that. Appliance upgrading is something we're constantly doing, and more needs to be done. But yes, a lot can be accomplished there. And like, for example, we've converted the village to compact fluorescent lights for the most part. And we've gotten rid of a lot of old refrigerators. We still have some more to go. We bought front-load washing machines. And, of course, the installation, better hot water heaters and
as
those kind of things.
We, I think, yeah, especially you being here all the time, I'm just wondering, is that something that a group of people that aren't here trying to live here from the outside can do a lot of research and can and do some fundraising or do some, you know, grant writing or whatever that would help make that process more swift or easier, you know? I'm just wondering how that happens or if that's ever happened.
Well, conservation is one of the primary focuses of our committee, and we make every effort possible to encourage the board and those people who are responsible for budget for the village to make those changes as quickly as they can. But the important thing is, or the difficult part is the funds, and I think we do have a significant change in our fundraising activities right now that will certainly have a benefit in that area as well.
One of the packages I brought up today, it's the river right now, that mm-hmm. some of our committee members did do a thorough inventory of all the different types of energy savings that could occur within the village, including the computers and everything else. So there is a report that we now have available from the subcommittee of our Science Technology Committee mm-hmm. on all of those things that it just came today, so yep. it's just here.
Haven't had a chance to look at it, but there's
that's
new information. There is data that's being collected, yep. Yes, Chuck?
Is there a possibility to tie that purple pipe project into the water coming out of the mine?
Bob?
No. the reason is that the water coming out of the mines is that contamination in and by itself is part of the problem.
Right.
And so the purple pipe system, the way it's designed right now, is to tap just ahead of the hydro facility. And basically, it would just be used under emergency conditions, except for lawn sprinkling that would occur. But that'd be a very small quantity of water that would occur. To go to the water coming out of the mines would be a substantially more expensive capital expenditure, plus then you get the water quality problem.
Well, I'm assuming that they're going to put some kind of pond into or whatever, as you mentioned there. And the water coming out of that has to be more pure than the water coming out of the mine. And there has to be some.
You wouldn't have any head, though.
Pardon?
We don't have the head.
Pressure.
The advantage of using the penstock is that we have 800 feet of pressure.
Well, the mine is up there pretty high, too.
The treatment system would be in the kind of the lower west area, by the lagoon area, by the bridge, the vehicle bridge.
Why?
So that the water treatment system could take advantage of the head between the mine and the treatment system to transport the water without the use of pumps and aerate the water without the use of mechanical aeration systems. So by the time you get out of the bottom of that treatment system, you've pretty much used all the head that's available to do that.
So in other words, that head's not being wasted. It's going to work for the remediation.
Yeah. Okay.
Parker.
I'd like to just, for those who are not familiar with the village system a little bit, point out that some really excellent work has been done over the last, 5 or 6 years or even more. It's in the subject of the load control and the load shedding. And it's a very sophisticated system. It's evolved over time, but it's very, very effective. And in the periods where we're water limited in electric generation, which is all those, not right now, but in all those winter months, late fall and winter months, the village operates with a load factor around 95%. And if that number, if you're a utility guy, that number is phenomenally high. And I think that everybody should know that that is a very, very effective and rather sophisticated control scheme. And it's caused some problems in the extent it's affected some other things adversely, but overall it's been extremely effective, and that has helped an awful lot in getting maintaining this ability to squeak by, and it's a squeak by, but it's still getting by through those low flow months.
And that's thanks to Parker.
That's thanks to Rich.
Well, Rich and yourself, Parker. So it's the two of you together have done a great job in pulling all that together. Yeah.
What that means is we use every single watt of electricity before we burn any firewood or diesel fuel, and that's part of the conservation efforts. And that's saved us a lot of wood and a lot of gallons of diesel since that system is grown to where it is now.
Wayne,
yes.
Have you looked at wind generation for the village?
There's been some limited discussion about it, but there's not been any intensive assessment of that. But the winds here are so irregular. That's the main problem. We don't have the advantage of continuous wind. And perhaps to get a more reliable wind, we'd have to go up on the higher ridges, and by the time you bring that generated power back down, the cost gets to be prohibitive. Yeah.
And it's remarkably calm here in the wintertime when our greatest energy needs have been.
Yeah.
Although we've talked about it, and we'll continue to keep it, we won't dismiss anything out of hand. We've talked a little bit more about solar, which is something that's never made sense here before, because in the summer we got lots of hydropower, and in the winter we have no sun. But now there might be a window of time where we have a need as well as some sun. So there's some potential there, and that's something we've talked a little bit more about.
And the state of the art in solar generation has made some huge changes in the last 5 years. And so there is a very viable reality there for our late summer, early fall period.
One of the companies that's touting major breakthroughs in that down in the Bay Area, I believe it's called NanoSolar, they're talking about phenomenal efficiencies on solar that is... I don't know if you've heard about that company, but they've got tremendous funding.
Yeah.
They could completely shift the power balance in terms of use of solar, if it's true and if it works.
Well, as an example of the change in what's available in solar generation, I just purchased for my little 16-foot boat a solar system that's about that long and about that tall that will keep a 12-volt battery charged constantly when it's not in use, but it will also run my 12-volt refrigerator as long as there is sunlight. So there are some amazing changes occurring in that area. So it's an area that we will need to continue to focus on and see how it fits with our picture here.
We do have some small solar panels down at the A-frame of the CERN, some of you may have noticed, that operates lights and emergency radio down there. And that even works in the wintertime when there's very little light.
Harry?
It's a small area, but how strong is the wind through the mine? It's regular.
It's actually variable as well. It shifts depending on the temperature. Sometimes it sucks in.
I know it changes
portals,
direction.
It'll change direction. So you have periods of time when you don't have a strong flow, but that's a good question. It's strong enough that you can feel it, but I'm not sure if it'd be strong enough, how much you could, power you could generate from that flow. Maybe something to think about, I guess.
Another idea we've kicked around a little bit kind of brings the fire and ice things together. And that's biomass conversion, where we talked earlier about we have a valley here that's overloaded with fuel. And part of the problem for the Forest Service is the expense of getting that out of here. So one idea would be to keep it here and to burn it through a steam turbine or a boiler system that would be highly efficient and clean burning that would start to reduce valley fuels and to produce electricity and hot water. That's something Parker has been looking at and the committee's been talking about. There's a lot of hurdles to a system like that, but it's a really interesting concept.
There's a complete write-up on that that being presented tomorrow, and the copies of that will be available rather in detail. So if you want more on that, right?
If you want more information on that, why be sure to join us tomorrow in our activities.
Or ask myself.
Yep.
Just add a couple things. I worked for the power utility in British Columbia, Canada.
And we're no longer in the business of generating power ourselves. We're going to the private sector, letting them, I guess, provide us the generation. And we certainly have a very sort of green dimension, I guess, to our power purchasing. And about 15% of the power that, in our last call for power, is going to be wind power. And the vast majority is run on the river hydro. It's very similar to what we have up here on the Copper Basin. The other thing you talk about solar cells as well, so we also have a policy of net metering. So if people have power, anybody has the right to sell it to BC Hydro. But we only have about 5 or 6 people out of 1.8 million customers take us up on it. It's just, you know, it's just not cost effective at this point. You know, that's very consistent with people's
That's occurring also in the area where I grew up in Montana, where the wind blows a lot. On the east face of the Rocky Mountains, there's a lot of the farms and ranchers in that area that are installing wind systems that sell power back to the power utility, the REI, in that area.
Well, no, just across the border as well, in Alberta, southern Alberta, around Carson, mm-hmm. the same thing.
Right.
There's been a technical breakthrough on wind, too, that maybe I'll mention for those that are interested. Can I take a minute?
Sure.
Okay, traditionally, wind generators were of no use if they couldn't be rotated, if the generator part of the unit wasn't rotating at the synchronous speed, that is the speed required to get 60 hertz power. Okay, now the small wind units are DC, that's a whole different ballgame, okay, so we're not talking about that, we're talking about the bigger one. And there has been some developments where some bright engineers says, well, I'm losing a lot of low velocity wind. I can't do anything with it because it doesn't get me up to 60 hertz power. So he says, okay, I don't really care what kind of frequency I'm going to generate. I'll generate it 50 or 40 or 30 or 20 or whatever, and I'll rectify it and invert it to 60 hertz power. The net result of that thing in general has been that the cost of the wind turbine installation went up to about 150% of what it was initially without that feature. Okay, but the annual production went to 200% because it was taking advantage of a lot of the low velocity winds that previously we had to be ignored. Okay, and that's a more sophisticated version, but it has made a major change in the wind. Unfortunately, at this time, it's still only being applied to large scale wind, where the cost per tower with that system is over $1 million. Okay, but I suspect that we will see some of that technology applied to smaller wind units. Okay. Now, the little wind units that you see in some farmer's yard are direct current, and they're usually associated with battery-based systems, and that's a completely different situation.
I have a question. With the current hydro, is there any information on if that was... With the structure was mainly left with technology, some different systems were in that we could produce with what's there or with even less, more power than we're producing right now. I mean, since they are old,
right.
Are they, for what's happening, is it with the technology that's available, it's way in capacity?
We could create some efficiency by upgrading the equipment.
Right.
Parker, you want to?
Not very much, but yes, a little bit. We could change the well-set exciters. We pick up a little bit. Right now, we've got a little ranging problem in number 2 unit, the one's running right now, that we're wasting 500 watts or so in the exciter system. But the gains are really small. Okay.
The Pelton wheel is an extremely efficient system. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to find a more efficient system than that technology that was developed a long time ago. You know,
one thing that has been talked about is to extend the penstock up higher elevation and increase the pressure, and then you'd increase your generation somewhat. Then that could possibly happen someday. It would be expensive, and it would. We're running up towards the wilderness area up there, so there's a limit to how far it could go up without that famous act of Congress. But that's probably the one way you could get more out of the system.
along those same lines, that I want to throw out another option that is a good way of converting heat to electricity. And that could be in the form of bio-waste. So a burning of bio-waste of some kind, similar to the bio-mass that we talked about with the forests. And that's using an engine called Stirling Generator. I've had the fortunate opportunity for working with a company that's built such engines for the government, and they have a very high efficiency. The Stirling engine is higher efficient than the Otto engine, and they just simply convert thermal energy to electrical energy for work, and the thermal can be from any source. So I think there might be some advantages of looking into using a Stirling engine. They've been around for a couple hundred years. The technology isn't new, but I think the ways that they are making the engines now are more advantageous or usable. So
as a member of the Science and Tech Advisory Committee, Quentin, we'll look forward to some additional research from you.
They're a costly engine to buy.
Yes.
They're not cheap by any means, but they can run continuously for a very long period of time. And the engines that I've worked on personally are hermetically sealed engines, so no maintenance really is needed, for these engines over a period of 10 to 20 years. So there's a lot of advantages, especially in remote locations such as ours.
Something else we've talked about is fuel cells as some future possibility, especially if it helps us to create annual storage of our hydroelectric power, where we have a surplus during part of the year and a deficiency in another part of the year.
Could that be done with solar as well, to store solar?
I suppose. Anyone know?
Which fuel cells?
You could power a fuel cell with solar power.
Any time you make electricity, you can always break it down to hydrogen and oxygen and then combine them again. And the answer is yes. Solar is any way you can make electricity.
But we already have a surplus of hydropower in the summer, or in the early part of the summer at least, and if that continues, then that's already in place.
And there are now new developments in the flywheel designs, which are looking extremely attractive for temporary storage of energy, and by temporary I mean of the order of days to weeks, not months, but days to weeks, which would help, I think, smooth out some of the cycles that we get here in the village, where we have pulses of energy use which shut down the system. If you had temporary storage, you could draw on that.
We do have temporary storage now in the form of hot water, both for space heating as well as domestic use. We essentially heat all our hot water, and a lot of it for space heating at night, and then use it during the day, and that helps to even out those spikes. So we have a very flat load curve and use the power pretty much evenly 24 hours a day. So we do have short-term storage. Our new boilers are 100 gallons of storage water in it. We heat up at night, and that continues to heat the building for the next day or so. And all of our shower water is heated at night at 20-minute intervals as available power is available. Mike?
I haven't been your first on fire and ice. Actually, the first time I heard you, it had theological implications, because it's a Benjamin Britten song regarding, but in any case, when you mentioned additional storage, Cheyenne County Port District at this particular point, for example, is seriously working with a number of people. You've heard of PHEV, pluggable hybrid electric vehicles, being a Prius driver-wide. I thought that brought that up here, that we could show that the solar charging in a place like Dan's Camp could be additional storage on vehicular. They're applying it now to larger vehicles, buses and trucks. And so there'll be some of these transport things where if we don't have the solar, for example, I was going to ask you, whatever ended up happening to the solar venture that Alcoa / Schlamm kind of PUD was going to perhaps offer the school, it got interrupted by the fire situation last year, Steve. But I wondered if between those issues of collecting solar energy storage and batteries for electric vehicles. So there's lots of subjects. I actually have that little quick list that Bob was referring to if you wanted to hear. There's some of these people who could be on our committee if you wanted to actually hear some of the proposed things. It was done in a matrix form. These technologies were weighed against what they cost, how effective they would be, how long they would last. So taking all those issues into effect, any one of them could be talked about. But the quick list shown here in this group that I didn't fulfill my portion of, the commercial kitchen, cooking, steamers, the washer, meaning the dishwasher, some of these heat exchanger options that occur in the kitchen as well as the chalets, special lighting. Then there were an area that he studied at some length of deductions and credits that occur at government levels. Behavior modification, which is the one that you mentioned, conservation, certain small devices that can measure smaller methods of saving energy, and then even things down to the jacuzzi cover and things of that nature. So, but these, the reason I ended up speaking just now too was because I'd been listed as transport implications. I'd always wanted to reinstitute the tram from the dance camp down to the ferry landing, the dock, and thereby saving all the trucking.
Yeah.
In any case, with V2G concept, this is why Chelan County PUD, Chelan County Port District, and Austin Power, a lot of people, when you ultimately get enough electric vehicles on the road and they aren't driven but 1 or 2 hours a day, then when they sit idle, they're meant to be tied into the grid and can be inverted and help feed make up for what you don't have when needed. Peaking, removing the need for peaking power. So there's a lot of areas that we just barely touched on, and I'm enthused that there's that much interest by others to follow up. I particularly want to get with you on the Stirling engine because I know how long we've been silent with that group.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. I think we've exhausted our energies for the evening, so thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it.